We're going to talk about governance right now, and we're joined by two of our speakers this morning, as well as Eli Greenblum, who's the Vice President of the Academy and is the Chair of the Pension Practice Council, which is our parent organization of the Forward Thinking Task Force. So, just to set the stage on governance, you know, this is the process by which decisions are made and implemented. And the key attributes that we think for a working governance system is that there should be some stakeholder participation, that there should be transparency with respect to the actions of the people involved in the governance, and that they have to be accountable for their actions and the what they've been assigned to do, as well as, you know, obviously administer in accordance with the law and their own guiding guidelines that they have established. And it's important that the governance structure works so that there is an effective delivery of these benefits that the people are getting. So, you know, these are the slides from earlier today about the key building blocks where we really think that we roles and responsibilities of everybody involved have to be defined, that there has to be a way to minimize or somehow address potential conflicts of interest. And perhaps that may just be the fact that everything is disclosed during the process. And the competing needs of the different stakeholders somehow has to be recognized and managed. And when we came up with that, we were actually thinking of some circumstances, like in the public sector here, you may have a situation where different bodies are responsible for different parts of the system, and somehow they have to figure out a way to work together. And we thought it was very important that that it was staffed appropriately, and that includes people with expertise or the ability to know how to hire people with expertise if the board doesn't have it itself. So clearly, people have to know what they have to know what they're responsible for, they have to know what their role is, and the people who are in the system have to understand who's responsible for what and who does what. And some of those roles include making sure that the funding is there, that everything, that you're working properly, that people are actually getting their benefits. And it's really important that once you've set up all these definitions of the roles and the responsibilities, that the people actually do it. We thought that that was critical. When we started looking at situations where there might have been breakdowns in governance, it was because even if they had everything well defined, somehow they were able to avoid actually carrying out their original responsibilities. And conflicts of interest is, you know, very real. We obviously proper disclosure, and it can be within the board as well as the people advising the board, that they, everybody who's involved needs to disclose when there is a conflict of interest to make it clear when decisions are made, whether they should recuse themselves or whether or not people can proceed with the knowledge of that proper disclosure. And I guess it wouldn't, you know, in the event that you can all do this, that maybe we can avoid some moral hazard involved with the administering of the plan and having people take actions that are in their best interests and not in the best interests of the system. So in recognizing in those competing needs, we are looking at, you know, trying to anticipate unintended consequences and really making sure that the rules and the regulations make the governance work and that it's not overly burdensome, but that things actually happen. And somehow incorporate it so that excessive risk-taking is not rewarded. And in this case, there also may be, as a way of protecting the people who are involved in the governance, the use of self-adjusting mechanisms that there, if there's, you know, we've heard both the New Brunswick plan has and the South Dakota plan have some self-adjusting mechanisms where there are triggers which will cause certain events to happen, and this will actually, in some ways, protect the people in the governance because of the fact that this is the way the system works, and they just can have it work without having to take extra action. And finally, it should be staffed appropriately, that you do need the use of independent experts and representatives of key stakeholders and everything. I mean, one of the things we thought was really critical with governance is that there was transparency with respect to the actions so that people knew what was going on. And that pay should be disclosed so that it's clear when that might affect people's actions. So here's a brief summary of the principles, and we will get into the questions. So in looking at our working governance structure, we identified these four principles. And I was wondering, Rob, or whether or not there are other elements of governance that you think are critical that we may have overlooked or should have expanded on.
The one point, at least for me, and again, it goes a little bit back to some of the conversations of this morning, is truly engagement. Bringing all the parties together that are stakeholders, however we're defining stakeholders, and making sure that everyone who is a party of interest has a say, has a opportunity to participate and really engage the subject. For our situation, that's been critical to make sure we have all those players involved, and that's the one piece that I might stress in the group, in the idea there of what's important to the whole process.
So Paul, in the New Brunswick system, one of the things we have, you know, when we were reading the material, it wasn't quite clear to us how the trustees, you know, were selected for the system.
Right. So maybe I can back up before the New Brunswick system.
Sure.
In 2003, I was retained by the UK Exchequer to Minister of Finance Gordon Brown to do an autopsy on why the pension system in the UK collapsed. That review was done by the head of one of the Oxford colleges, who was the former director of competition in the UK, Sir Derek Morris. And we essentially arrived at two dominating reasons, we felt. One had to do with the lack of professionalism, or maybe the conflict of interest that professionals had. So, and particularly actuaries. So frequently when times are good, actuaries had a due responsibility. They were advisors to the plan sponsor and they were advisors to the plan. And most times those interests are aligned. But when times are tough, they aren't necessarily aligned. And there's pressure on the professional. It's not just actuaries, but they were very much involved. To take sides, and often the plan sponsor was the one who hired the plan actuary, so the plan sponsor's needs got dealt with first. So the recommendation of the Morris Review was that actuaries could indeed, and other professionals could, service both the plan sponsor's needs and the plan's needs, but it was up to them to determine when there was a conflict of interest that was material. And at that time, they had to declare it and offer their services first to the plan, not to the plan sponsor. That was fairly radical, and it wasn't embraced with enthusiasm by the professions, but nevertheless, that's the general direction. It's up to the professionals to follow their codes of conduct, and when there is an apparent conflict of interest, they have to declare it to both sides. They could end up on either side, or they could end up pissing off both sides and end up with nothing, but they had to declare it. The second weakness in the system was the trustees, pension trustees. The Morris Review concluded that the professional qualifications of trustees were completely inadequate, and recommended that the UK should develop professional trustees. And this they've done. So if you go to the website of, they abolished the old pension regulator and set up something that's called the pension regulator, TPR, and they describe the qualifications of trustees. And so what the government has tried to do in the UK to rebuild the system is to encourage, I'll call them vigorous early retirees with financial backgrounds, to get qualified to be a pension trustee and get on a list of qualified pension trustees after they've taken some course, after they've, they may have enough background already, but generally they have to demonstrate they have background in fiduciary principles, investment, and so on. And then they get on a list. And then when firms need trustees, they go to that list to get people who are independent and who are knowledgeable. And I think they feel they're gradually rebuilding the system, but that sort of gets to the level of governance. You need trustees who are educated. Now, in the New Brunswick system, what we've tried to do is make sure that the role of the professionals to the plan is paramount. Okay, and so, and because contributions are effectively locked in with a very small variability, there's not the conflict of interest to operate with the needs of the plan sponsor as paramount, because the plan sponsor is locked into basically a fixed contribution schedule because it's a target benefit plan, a risk-managed target benefit plan. So in the design of the system, we've tried to take away the biggest conflict of interest for the professionals. Make it clear that the professionals advising the plan have a primary duty to the plan and not to anybody else. We're playing with the idea of going on down the line of the TPR and having professional people trained professionally to be pension trustees, but we haven't got there yet. What we've done is satisfy ourselves that all the initial boards we put in place have qualified people. The other thing on governance that we did, which is unique in the world, I think, we provided that half of the trustees should represent the plan members and half the plan sponsor. Well, that raises the possibility of a deadlock. So when the board is set up, they have to designate the individual who's going to be the tiebreaker. Oh. And the tiebreaker's not allowed to attend the trustees' meetings until such time as there's a deadlock. And when there's a deadlock, both sides explain their position and the tiebreaker makes the decision, no recourse by the trustees. Well, this is like a game of Russian roulette. What we've found so far, in very limited experience, is knowing that that designated tiebreaker's up out there provides a real incentive to find a solution without going to the tiebreaker. I don't know if that makes sense, but that was actually Sue Rowland's idea. She was a former pension regulator from Ontario and a prominent labor lawyer in the pension field, and she's just said, you put this system in place and you won't have an impasse in the board. They'll avoid it like the plague.
Interestingly, in the multi-employer world today in the US, all boards, and according to the Taft-Hartley concept that was established way back in the 40s, those boards are 50% management, 50% union. Those are the sponsors, the board of trustees, and there's an arbitration system. So when the board deadlocks, it goes to an arbitrator. You don't know in advance who that arbitrator will be, but it'll be appointed by the American Arbitration Association, and they tend to pick people who know what they're doing. They don't always act quickly. And I think it's resulted in much fewer disagreements than not having a good mechanism. The arbitrators tend to make sound decisions, and there's sometimes recourse to go beyond the arbitrator to the court system. Especially in cases of withdrawal liability. I would say that, just to answer the original question, and maybe Rob's too modest to say it this way, but I think a strong executive and also strong counsel, legal counsel and actuarial counsel. I think those are fundamental to having a working governance structure. Rob mentioned his efforts to work with the legislature, and the legislature being very involved and being very interested in, apparently, not repeating the process that occurred just before your arrival, when the system went from 5% from employees and employers to 6%. I guess that was as a result of the downturn in the markets in the early part of the decade, 2000s, plus the feeling that the benefits were not adequate. And, you know, went a different route, and obviously managed to get through the next financial crisis with some pain, but shared pain, as you described, and I think that was a really good model. I think managing conflicts is the role of that executive as well, focusing the trustees on their fiduciary duties and avoiding politics if at all possible. Some boards I've seen are very politically conscious. The best boards I've seen are not. I can think of one board, 11 members, two appointed by the state. It was a municipal retirement system. The other nine, in fact, were stakeholders in the sense that they were the employees and employers representing the different types of municipalities in the system. But with strong guidance from the executive, I think they were able to focus on that fiduciary hat and not on their other roles that brought them to the board.
So, I mean, really, one of the things I think that when we were struggling with coming up with our criteria for the governance is so much of either good governance or examples of bad governance relates to the individuals involved. So, what steps can be taken to make sure that the individuals that get on the board, are the type that are willing to work together or is it that you need something like the stick of the arbitration if the boards can't work together?
Let me see if I can take a run at that. What happens over time in a board, and I have a large board, 17 members, it works out that you try and build the momentum for fiduciary thought, that is, plan first, representation second, and really build the effort towards making the right decision for everyone. And so I think the solutions are sometimes difficult, but I try not to bring problems to the board that are going to put them at odds. I try and put it into a position that behind the scenes, the solutions are found before we put ourselves into a situation of conflict and needing to have that arbiter. But it's every board's going to evolve differently. I find that within the board, the pressure that each trustee puts on the next and the cooperation that they give to each other is almost a little like that playground of your peers, and how they react is the way you will react as a new peer, as a new trustee, as you see your other trustees functioning in a certain way, you function that way. And sometimes it can go the wrong way for you, but at least sometimes I think it leads them in the right path.
I can give you examples of governance that's really worked out well and built something. So let me take the Pipefitters plan in New Brunswick. Their investment manager, well, describe him as a gold bug. So he rode gold up to $1,800 an ounce. And when they came to register in this plan, we just said, that's too risky. You have to reduce that holding now. And as it turned out, they happened to hit the top of the market, and the plan would have been insolvent had they gone back down to $1,200 or $1,300. So the having to submit a risk analysis and having to explain what you're doing and why you're doing and why the investments are appropriate saved that plan. Now, that's not the way it started out. We had a fair bit of discussion with them. I mean, he really believed in gold. And so in any case, having to go through a formal risk analysis and say, that's too risky, no matter how good I think it's gonna perform, I have to get rid of that top end to save going into the bottom end. That's made believers out of the trustees of the plan, save them from real trouble.
Do we have any questions from the audience?
It's right there.
There you go. Lee Snell with the National Council on Teacher Retirement. I think Paul has already answered this question, so I'll ask Rob and Eli. To paraphrase Paul, do you think the only good trustee is a trained professional trustee? I'd just like to have your thoughts on trustee qualifications, trustee education, the right people who serve as trustees on these plans. Thank you.
You want to take the first run?
Yeah, I don't think that's the only kind of trustee that'll be successful. I think boards can structure themselves, again, relying on the professionals heavily for certain decisions and going through training programs. Is very important, both the kinds of programs offered for multi-employer and public sector trustees by the International Foundation of Employee Benefit Plans. If the trustees treat it as a real educational opportunity and not a boondoggle, because so often those things are held in, you know, desirable places like Las Vegas and Hawaii. But the trustees who've gone to it and gone to the sessions, I think, have gotten a lot out of it. Some boards have training manuals, have mandatory sessions with the professionals. And as Rob said, many boards meet really to only discuss the big picture issues. The technical issues are worked out in advance by the professionals with some representation of the board. But I do think that board members who have an avid interest in exactly what the benefits are and exactly what the contributions are, I don't think that's a bad thing. I do think that a poor example is when in the U.S. private sector single employer retirement system, to go back to what Paul started, largely it's been the plan sponsor. That's really the only entity. It's the employer, the actuary works for the employer, the actuary can be switched out, the lawyers can be switched out, accountants can be switched out, and having no representation of anyone but one entity, I don't think makes for adequate decision making.
The whole idea of trustee training is really difficult for some of us because my board is very much of a lay board. 4 times a year, typically, we meet together. I travel and see my board members constantly during the year, but it's still periodic for them. We set up training internally. We do orientations for them. We include training in every council, you know, every board meeting. Offer them training to attend conferences, attend professional programs. But the fact is I have lots of board members that don't get out and I can't affect, I don't have a legislation that says you have to take so many hours of this. And so you really have to spend the time with them. I catch a little grief because I have a tendency to force them to go through say a topic area 2 or 3 times before we really come in with the intention of trying to take a vote and make a decision on it, just because of the fact that they are a lay board and they don't have the opportunity to spend much time on things, and you really have to do a slow due diligence in many cases just to bring them there. And so I appreciate the plans that do require training. I don't happen to have that luxury, but we do everything we can to try and give them the best information we can.
Yeah, if I can use the New Brunswick Public Service Plan, the chair of the board is the head of the nurses' union. She is a palliative care nurse. Nurses are the smallest union in the public service, but she somehow, for some reason, took a real interest in pensions and has attended the IF meetings and courses, and she's become somewhat of an expert in pension governance. So notwithstanding that it would be normal to have a government-nominated representative of chair. The government was quite happy to have a labor leader as the chair of the public service union because they had a very capable person. But she did have the qualifications. And as a palliative care nurse, she's sort of the right person to deal with politicians.
John.
I'm John Turner, Pension Policy Center. The question is for Paul. I was really interested in your comment about the conflict of interest that actuaries have, which becomes an issue when things are going poorly. And could you just elaborate a little bit about that and how it's dealt with in Canada? And maybe also comment about if it's an issue in relationship to the first panel you were on, which is the public sector plans, where you know, clearly many of them are in trouble in the United States.
Yeah. Typically, what used to happen and still happens to some extent in Canada is that where there's these conflict of interest exists, that the actuary obtains from both sides a letter waiving the conflict of interest and says you can serve both of us. Call it an autopsy because that's about what it was of the UK pension system. We said that didn't work because the plan sponsor in effect made the hiring decision for the professionals. And when push come to shove and they had a letter of comfort saying that both sides deemed there wouldn't be a conflict of interest, the professionals favored the plan sponsor. And they made decisions if the plan sponsor was short of cash, they were slow in recognizing bad news. Or they were fast in taking more risks and so on. They went up the risk curve to try and So this isn't a general observation, but it's something that we found when we were doing that. Now, we haven't taken the steps that they've taken in the UK to that you can't rely on a letter of comfort from both sides saying, you know, use your best judgment, and that you have to declare a conflict of interest when you see it's material. But I want to tell you, I was really comfortable signing that report in the UK saying that that was the professional's obligation. It wasn't just the actuaries, the investment people, the lawyers, and so on. They can get into position, and they all have codes of conduct explaining what to do when there's a conflict of interest. But what was happening is that people were waiving it when the conflict of interest wasn't material. And then when it became material, the professionals were using the letter of comfort as they saw best, and often what they saw best was in the interest of client retention. So that may be a really cynical view, but nevertheless, that's the conclusion that the dozen of us who did the work in the UK came up with.
Frank?
Frank Tedesco, GAO. Eli, you mentioned when you have just one entity making the decisions, the employer, it's not a great governance model. You've all talked about other governance models where you have both employer and participant representation among the trustees. One could imagine a situation, private sector, public sector, anywhere, where even with that model where you have that dual representation among the trustees, that both the employer and the employee representatives might not want to recognize some bad news. So is there a need for some third party on boards?
I'm not sure that the only way to deal with that is through additional board members. Let me give you what I think is a primary example. In the US multi-employer arena, it was deemed about 10 years ago, before the 2008 crisis, but after the 2002 downturn in the markets, that trustees needed to have more discipline placed on them. And what came out of that was the Pension Protection Act, which for multi-employer plans was very different than for single-employer plans. For multi-employer plans, it created an environment where the actuary who was working for the joint board, and there really wasn't the other parallel, I mean, yes, there is this other entity, the collective bargaining parties determine what the amount of money will be to put into the plan as contributions. That's typically different people than the trustees, but they're related. In any case, the questions that the actuaries were getting in 2004, 5, 6 was, do we need to do anything? Can we continue to go along? Much as you said, Frank, that bad news has been out there, but are we going to be okay? And the actuary would say, well, you don't need to do anything, but my long-term cost is that, you know, you need to be putting in $3 an hour into this plan instead of $2 an hour. But do we need to do it now? No, you don't need to do it now. PPA came along and said the trustees are going to have to go into a long-term analysis. The actuary will provide a grading system for plans based on how they do on various metrics, too complicated to go into here. But if the plan is graded as critical or endangered, those trustees need to come up with a remedial plan that will correct the situation to the extent they can. And there was a small subset back when PPA was implemented in 2008 and today that are not going to be able to dig their way out. It's probably only about 5% of the plans. But for the other 90 to 95%, they had to set up schedules of benefits and contributions. The trustees then told the bargaining parties, this is the only basis on which you can continue. You will either have to cut benefits, raise contributions, or both. Otherwise, you're out of the plan, and there are consequences to being out of the plan. So I think that discipline helped a lot. The look forward was about 7 years, and then the remedial plans took things out to about 12 to 15 years. So that long-term view, I think, really helped. And PPA, as I said, has its shortcomings. There are a set of plans that are not going to make it. And in addition, there's a lot of employer resistance to getting into the plans. Those employers that can withdraw without much cost, many of them are doing that. And that's led to a reevaluation in the multi-employer system that was spearheaded by the National Coordinating Committee of Multi-Employer Plans, whose Assistant Director Josh Shapiro is sitting over there, and they went through a long, about 18-month process of coming up with new ideas. None of them have been turned into formal congressional legislative proposals yet, but that's to come. And Josh, you may want to comment on one of the new designs that gets into the different model of governance having to do with a plan that will be flexible. It'll target towards a defined benefit, but will provide adjustments that the trustees will need to make.
Yeah, thanks, Eli. Yeah, your summary of PPA was very much similar to the conversations that our group went through over the course of about a year and a half, talking about sort of what PPA did and what was working. And in the end, the conclusion of our group was that PPA was very much the right direction in all the ways that you listed there. And our feeling was that the only shortfall was it didn't go far enough. So we took to coming up with some ideas for, you know, reform in the multi-employer system for new ways of doing things that the plans can use that, you know, very much build on all the aspects of PPA that you mentioned. And I'll highlight just three of them real quickly. One of them is the idea of looking down the road as opposed to where you are now. The proposal that we have out there makes almost no mention of your current funded ratio, just more or less, you know, ignores it. In determining whether or not you meet the requirements, it's entirely based on a projection of the funded ratio. That's all that matters. You know, where is the plan projected to be 15 years down the road drives the entire equation. The second part of it would be, you know, early intervention, so that if that projection down the road shows, you know, any kind of a shortfall down the road, even if it's, you know, 15 years down the road, there is no option of waiting. The trustees are obligated to take action today to correct that, to make sure that we don't get to a position where plans are facing insolvency, which unfortunately some of our plans are right now. And then the third part of it is, you know, PPA took a move towards a system where the employers and the bargaining parties, you know, the contributions that they negotiate really is the end-all be-all of the plan. PPA has a provision in there which is, you know, very critical to us right now, which is called the all reasonable measures provision, which basically means that if there's a shortfall in the plan, the employers have to come up with more money, but there's a cap on that much on that money, which is what can be reasonably supported by the industry. And there is not a requirement that they put in more than they can defend as being kind of the reasonable maximum. The thinking is if they're required to put in more than that, then they're going to leave, and that's even worse. So our proposal takes that a step further and really is clear that in this new design that we're trying to get out there, the employers are liable only for what's negotiated and never any more. There's a, you know, there's no concept of minimum funding requirements. The equation actually works the other way, where the bargaining parties determine how much money will come into the plan, and then the trustees decide what to do with that money. PPA, again, took a kind of a step in that direction. This design takes a much further step. And the flip side is that, you know, if the trustees look down the road and see that there's going to be a funding shortfall 15 years later, based on the amounts that the bargaining parties have chosen to allocate, they're empowered very, very early to take corrective action to bring that equation back into line. There's actually a hierarchy of steps that they're kind of required to look at. And the final step in that hierarchy is if they have to reduce benefits to make it work, then they're empowered to do so, you know, subject to various constraints. And, you know, we're trying to learn the lessons that some of our plans are seeing right now. Eli mentioned we have, you know, maybe 5%, maybe a few more percent of our plans that are facing insolvency. Right now, they're doing nothing. There's nothing more they can do. They've put as much money as they can into the plan. There's no more money to be had. Future benefits have been cut to as little as possible. And they're just sitting around and waiting for the money to run out. And when the money runs out, they're going to go to the PBGC and take, you know, 60, 70% benefit cuts in some case with the PBGC guarantee. But if they had been empowered to act 5 years ago when the market first crashed, they could have righted the course with much more modest changes, in some cases 10%, 15% changes. So the thinking behind this proposal is always look down the road, and as soon as you see kind of a bump in the road, act immediately, so that if there are going to be changes that have to be made, they're as, you know, modest and small as possible by addressing them as early as possible. So that's sort of a, kind of a whirlwind tour of what we came up with as being part of our proposal.
We'd like to see it sometimes so we can assess it.
Yes. Yeah.
And we look forward to that.
Future assessment fodder.
That's right.
Can I just point out that the UK, the US, and Canada have taken three very different paths. The UK has legislation. In effect, you're asking in UK and Canada to have a whistleblower to go to the regulator when the plan or the financial institution's in trouble. And in the UK, by statute, people with whistleblowing duties have legal immunity. They don't have professional immunity. If they don't discharge their professional obligations, they can have, be at professional peril, but they have legal immunity. In Canada, we have also adopted the idea of legal immunity. So the first in insurance companies, the appointed actuary of an insurer has to whistleblow if there's a situation that he meets a certain threshold in the law. And originally the government offered qualified privilege, which as I understand it is protection against libel. But the professionals involved went and said, if we're going to discharge this, we need a stronger immunity. We need legal immunity from suit. And interestingly enough, the Canadian Bar Association came as a friend of the court to the Senate and said, if you're going to impose these whistleblowing duties in the interest of society, you have to protect the whistleblower against us, the lawyers. And so the Canadian law was changed to do exactly that. In the New Brunswick legislation on the trustees, with the people with the whistleblowing duties, they have immunity. That's right in the act. So that's if they've been operating in good faith. But as I understand it, that creates a fair legal hurdle towards somebody suing them to ruin them. So they have immunity. No, it's not absolute immunity, but they have immunity if they're operating in good faith. So that's in our legislation.
Great. I think we have one last question, and then last
question. Yes, going back to Frank's question about dealing with the conflicts of interest, if both on a joint board, both sides of the table really do not want to deal with an issue, I guess I'd like the panelists comment on another way that has been discussed in the accounting profession, and that the professionals are appointed for a fixed term, and it's generally non-renewable. Any early departures of the professional, of the accountant, would have to be discussed with the appropriate regulators. So then that way the professionals want to do the best job, realizing at a certain point in time there's going to be another professional who's going to be looking at exactly what they did and asking questions if they don't agree.
Let me jump in with one thing that we do, and it's not on the retirement system board, but it's on the investment council board. And we have, in that case, five of the eight trustees are independent, appointed by the legislature as experts in the financial field, and they have non-renewable seats on that council. They serve for 5 years, they roll off, and it forces that next look, that next person down the line, and it's been really helpful for us, particularly in the investment side, where maybe the level of expertise is better suited to a non-elected type participant trustee, because they already bring the professional status to the council, and then that role provides an ongoing professional look. And so we've used it there on the investment side.
In Europe, what you suggested was essentially the model. They've gone to a system of having a reporting actuary who's works for the plan, and a reviewing actuary who's independent of the plan, and where the reviewing actuary's appointment rotates, and they're there to be the whistleblower, and that's fairly specific. In the Canadian financial institution, same thing. There's a limit put on how long auditors can audit a financial institution. They just have to rotate the job. I gather that's been discussed in the States and has been shot down, in Canada, also for actuaries of insurance companies, they have a plan actuary and a reviewing actuary. And the reviewing actuary, if the plan actuary loses his job, he has to send a report to the regulator indicating why, in his opinion, he lost the job, what were the disputes, and that dispute has qualified privilege. It's not subject to libel.
In the public sector, and to some extent in the multi-employer arena as well, actuaries and other professionals are regularly reviewed. There's normally a 5 or so year cycle, and there's open bidding. There are actuarial audits of various types, especially important for boards that are not 100% sure that they believe what they're hearing, since they don't like what they're hearing. So I'm not sure that a mandatory rotation makes sense. One of the main things I think a professional advisor brings to the table is the history. I know that on some of the boards that I serve, I'm by far the longest serving person in the room. And I think it's important to have that historical expertise, and the building up of trust is something you can't just replace by hiring a new face.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Really appreciate all these good thoughts. Thanks.